WFNI, 93 WIBC, HD2, Indianapolis.
AJ
from the racing capital of the world. This is the talk of Gasoline Alley.
For Alan Sir, winner of the...
Brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice.
Contact wins it by less than 1/10 of a second.
Now, here's the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Donald Davidson and Kevin Lee.
Welcome back to Indianapolis Motor Speedway. I'm Kurt Cavan, sitting alongside Donald Davidson at the fourth floor media center, and we're about to embark on a shortened version of the track of the talk of Gasoline Alley. It's a shortened version because we have a basketball game tonight. This is a show about the history of the Speedway and nostalgia, and we're going to get right to it. Are you ready, Donald?
Sure. It's shortened version, but I guess we're lucky to have a show.
Well, it's gentlemen, start your engines tonight. We're going to start first with Tom. Tom, are you with us tonight on the talk of Gasoline Alley?
Hello, Tom.
Well,
Tom?
There we go.
All right. Somebody, okay, Tom? Good. Yes.
Yeah. I'd like to have Donald talk about in 1964 when the rear engine cars started to come, how the different types of cars that evolved during that time, like the Shrike and the Huffaker and all those kind of things. There was a lot of different rear engine designs. I wonder if he could comment on that and talk about who those people were and so forth.
Okay. Over what period? I mean, just like at the very beginning? Okay, rear engine cars were not new at the Indianapolis Speedway. There were several between 1937 and 1951. Only four qualified. They were not successful. Then the second wave, if you like, 1961 was the Cooper with Jack Brabham. And then in 1960, that was the only rear engine car that was in the race. Actually, there was another one at the track. John Zink entered one that was supposed to have a turbine in it, and the chassis arrived, but the engine didn't. And it ended up that the car was never on the track. They put an offie in it later, but I'm just confusing the issue here. In 1962, Mickey Thompson had three cars built, and there was a fellow whose name, I believe, was John Crosthwaite, who was a former Lotus employee, and they built three cars that kind of resembled the Cooper a little bit. And there were three of those. Dan Gurney qualified the only one. And there was another rear engine car, which was a John Zink turbine-powered car, but it was a different chassis from the year before. It was built by Denny Moore and his associates in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And it's in the museum right now, actually on display. And they built it themselves, but it looks like a Cooper in the front, and it looks like a Lotus 18 in the back. Then in 63, Lotus came with three cars and qualified two. They built them themselves, if you're asking about the people. And then the Mickey Thompson stable was expanded to five with two new cars that were wider, or would appear to be wider, but they were lower and flat and had little tiny wheels. And I may be missing some, but then in 64, then it really starts to come. Rollof Allstead built a car that Len Sutton drove, and A.J. Watson built two, one for Roger Ward, one for Don Branson. And they were very close to the Allstead design. In fact, I think Allstead let Watson copied the car, basically. It was a very, very similar in appearance. And then you've got new Lotuses, and then you had the Lotuses that were held over from the year before. So there was Jim Clark and Dan Gurney had new ones, and then Bobby Marshman led the race with what I believe was a 1963 car, updated, but considerably. And then there were the Shrikes, and there were quite a few of those. Ted Hallibrand built them. And then Mickey Thompson had three cars that had completely different bodywork, and I've never really been able to determine, because I'm not a gearhead type or chassis type. Once you get into the rear engine cars, I don't know if they were any of the 1962 or 63 cars rebodied, or whether they were brand new. I don't know that. Maybe somebody out there does. And then there was another one called the Delta International Mover Special, which was an Al Dean car. I don't know what that was, and I don't think that one arrived. It certainly wasn't on the track. And then in 65, now we've got Lotuses all over the place. And then the Gerhards, Fred Gerhard, who was an owner, had his own car built for 65. And then before long, they sort of went on the assembly line. And Phil Casey saw, I don't know how many they built, and there were several generations. I don't quite know where to stop this, because a little later on they had the wedge shape Gerhard, but the early ones were sort of like cigar shaped. And then the Huffaker, Joe Huffaker built three cars, or had three cars. He built three cars for the 64 race, and they were quite a bit different in appearance from the others, very distinctive. And ran Offenhausers. Shell Quavali was the owner, and spell Shell Quavali. And if you start with an S, you got it wrong. It starts with a K. And then let's see. There was the RCRO Maserati that Al Unser took his rookie test in was, I think, built by Pete Weissman, the gearbox guy, I think. Hmm. And then I'm missing one that was in 64. There was Parnelli Jones had a rear engine car. Now, this was the thing in 64, that all of the lead drivers, rear engine cars obviously was the way, but not everybody was convinced yet. And so they didn't call them backups, but you would have a front engine car to fall back onto. So Roger Ward, Don Branson, Foyt, Parnelli, and several others, they had a front engine car, and at least one front engine car and a rear engine car available to them. Ward and Branson went with the rear engines. Foyt and Parnelli decided to stay with the roadsters, and Parnelli had a rear engine car. And trying to think of all the different thoughts that I should try to get in here. Troutman and Barnes built his, and it wasn't very successful. And Parnelli very quickly said, "No, I don't think I can do it in this." And so the following year, a fellow named Myron Osborne, Ozzy Osborne, who was a real character. This guy was the old type of sportsman car owner. He had a used car lot in Denver. It wasn't even a new dealership. It was a used car dealership, a used car lot. And so anyway, he had, in 64, he'd had what had been the Metal Cow special that Jimmy Bryan and Chuck Stevenson and Johnny Boyd had driven. And then in 65, he bought the car, the Troutman and Barnes car. And so George Sally was the chief mechanic, or had been mechanic for Ozzy. And George said, Ozzy calls up and said, "George, I bought a rear engine car." And he said, "Well, what did you get?" I said, "Well, the Troutman and Barnes that Parnelli had." And he said, "Well, what are you going to do with that?" He said, "Well, we're going to go racing." And so George said, "Well, who's going to drive it?" And he said, "I don't know, we'll get a driver. And, you know, you're the mechanic." And George said, "I don't want to work on that. You know, look, Parnelli couldn't drive it. Who are you going to get?" So anyway, little anecdote to throw in there. Now we're getting to 66. And Watson went to a second generation rear engine car, which looked much better. I mean, it was more aesthetically pleasing than the 64s, but they didn't have the success. And we need to take a break and a breather here, and I'll try and think of a bunch more that were one-offs.
Thanks, Tom, for that. Yeah, let's take a break, and we'll come back with Mike here on the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Welcome back to the world's greatest raceway, and this is the Talk of Gasoline Alley with the great historian Donald Davidson. I'm Kurt Cavan, and let's get back to this topic we were finishing up with.
To wrap up, and I'm sure I'm missing a bunch here, the Eagle comes in, the Gurney Eagle in 66. The first Foyt Coyote was 66. And I'm sure that, the Lola?
Yeah.
Lola was new in 65. And there was Parnelli had one, which he chose instead, had it at his disposal, chose instead the the Lotus that Clark had been on the pole the year before, and he got second with that. And then Foyt had a Lola. He had a Lotus and a Lola. So the rear engine car was parked, and he chose the Lotus, and then the Lola was turned over to Al Unser, who made his debut that day. He was a rookie and ended up ninth, but he was running sixth late in the race. And the Lola that did the best, and this was really probably Bud Tinkelstad. That was probably Tinkelstad's best 500, and the results don't show it, but he was driving for Lindsay Hopkins, and it was the American Red Bull Special. And he got it up to third, and then had an accident, and the wheel came off, and then he hit the wall. In fact, everybody was sort of so nervous after the 64 race that in 65, thank goodness it was a relatively trouble-free race, and that was the only wall contact. And I remember I was across the street, the Holiday Inn across the street, and a lot of drivers stayed there. And so after the race, and I don't know how I got over there because I wasn't driving yet, but I ended up in this hotel room, and it was Boyd and Stevenson and Tinkelstad and Bob Veith, and they were talking about, you know, some of them had been in the race and others had missed it. And they said to Tinkelstad, did the wheel come off before you hit the wall? He said, yeah. He said, I was spinning around looking up at the air at the wheel. But anyway, the funny thing about it was, this isn't the funny part, because, again, Tinkelstad had some great runs at other tracks, and he had good finishes at the Speedway, but I think in 65 was probably his best run, but the results don't tell it. But anyway, the funny thing was that here's Bud Tinkelstad, a sprint car guy, talking to the English crew and mechanics, and Eric Broadley was the Lola principal, and bless his heart, Tinkelstad thought his name was Bradley. He always called him Bradley. Anyway, I'm probably missing a few more, but we'll stop at 66. Kurt, who have we got next?
We've got Mike from Vernon Hills, Illinois. Mike, are you with us?
Hi, Mike.
Yeah,
are you back in Vernon Hills?
On my way. Good thinking, I guess, Donald.
Oh, I saw Mike yesterday, and in fact, I spent some time in the museum lobby with Paul from Racine about an hour ago. Okay, Mike, what you got?
We were at the museum this week, and we were pretty intrigued by the Rudy Caracciola exhibit, and I wonder if you could talk about him and the exhibit.
Oh, well, that Caracciola exhibit is pretty impressive, and a lot of people wonder why it's there. It doesn't get as many comments as it did, but for the first few years, certainly. And Rudolf Caracciola was the great German driver before World War II, I should say, and there was no world championship yet. That wouldn't come until 1950, believe it or not. It took all those years to get to where they would have a points-paying world championship. But they did have a European championship, which was effectively the same thing, because in those days, all the Grand Prix were in Europe. So Caracciola was the champion in 35, 37, and 38. So he was Schumacher, he was Senna at the time. And He did run in the United States. He ran the 1937 Vanderbilt Cup, and I think he visited a couple of other times, because in his memoirs he talked about he came to the track. He came to the Speedway sometime in the 30s, and Pop Myers showed him around, and he talked about having gone to a couple of midget races on the East Coast. But and his wife was American born. Anyway. The war comes, and without getting into it too much, I mean, he was a German national with an Italian name, but he distanced himself and then moved to Switzerland and eventually became a Swiss citizen. So after the war, he came to the United States, but he entered a Mercedes. He had there were two 1.5-liter cars that they called the Triple E cars, and you either know what that is or don't worry about it, because it's a little complicated, but specially built Mercedes. And he was able to have possession of those during the war, and they hid them. And I mean, literally, it just sounds like movies, but they would, you know, hide them in haystacks and stuff like that. So the war was over, and he brings the thing out. Europe is having a hard time getting up off it. It takes a while to get off its knees. And so the first really major race in the world was the 1946 Indianapolis 500. So a bunch of Europeans came over, and Caracciola entered a Mercedes. Well, it was held up at customs, I think, in Europe, and they wouldn't let it out of the country. So Caracciola and the wife came anyway. Tony Holman and his wife had just bought the track. And they're both of German heritage, and whether there was a connection there or not, I really don't know. But Caracciola arrives, and he stays at the Murat Hotel, which is the apartments now, and all kinds of people stayed there. I mean, that was the place to stay, one of the major places to stay in the 30s and 40s and 50s. Look, film stars stayed there and everything, so that's where Caracciola was. Joel Thorne, the infamous Joel Thorne, had entered two cars for 46, George Robson to drive one, and Thorne was going to drive the other. But he'd been in a motorcycle accident and couldn't drive. I mean, he actually showed up to take his physical in a wheelchair. And I think he actually passed the physical, but they couldn't. But he couldn't drive. Well, be that as it may, he thought, well, you know, I'll get another driver. And knowing that Caracciola had come and the car was left behind, most of the people at the track in those days, I mean, you know, you didn't have people that followed all forms of racing. So, you know, without this coming out sounding wrong, most Americans had no idea who Caracciola was, but Thorne did, because he was interested in European racing. So he went to the hotel and I think left an envelope at the front desk and said, you know, can I come and talk to you? And so one thing led to another, and Caracciola drove Thorne's car. It's all at the last minute. He had to take a driver's test, a familiarization test, because everybody did. He had a cloth helmet, because hard helmets were mandatory in the United States in 35, but not in Europe until 52. So Caracciola, they had to go find him a helmet. Well, he goes out, takes the test, and then on May the 28th, when they're still qualifying, he has this terrible accident. Now, in his book, he said, I went out to qualify, I took the green flag, and that's the last thing I remember. Well, he didn't take the green flag. He was just practicing, and he had this big accident in turn two. And the belief is that he hit a bird. Now, there were all kinds of phony baloney stories about the fact that people thought he was a Nazi and they were taking pot shots with guns. It's all nonsense. He hit a bird. But he had this bad accident. So Tony Holman and the wife, they felt so bad about it because they just bought the track. And now this great European driver was injured at their track. And so Tony made sure that everything was okay and the hospital and everything. And then when he came out, they offered them the Lincoln Lodge in Terre Haute, the place to recuperate. And so Caracciola and the wife spent the summer in Terre Haute on Holman's property. And then finally September, they went home. Well, this obviously a very warm relationship had developed between them. Caracciola did come back to the United States a couple of times, but he never came to the 500. But the wife did. I met her in 69 or 70 or something. And so because of her affection for the Holmans and one thing and another, an arrangement was made whereby Caracciola's a phenomenal trophy collection would come to the track. Now, in those days, the prize money in Grand Prix racing was nothing. And it was about the cups and the trophies. And so he had not just what he won, but other stuff that he was given. And so the whole lot, I don't know, there may be a few that didn't come, but the greater part of the collection is there. And when it first showed up, I know that a lot of Europeans would come and knew who he was and what it was and thought, why is it here? And why isn't it in Stuttgart at the Mercedes-Benz place? They'd like to have it, but it's at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and that's the explanation.
It's a great story. Let's move on to Jason in Ocala, Florida. Jason, are you with us tonight?
I am. Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate it. Donald, I wanted to ask you about the sale of the Speedway in 1945.
Okay.
Were there other parties other than Mr. Holman that were interested in purchasing the track and continuing with the 500? And also, were there parties interested in purchasing the Speedway and doing something else with the property? And if there were, what kind of ideas did they have other than the racetrack itself?
A short sentence, all of the above. The thinking was that Rickenbacker headed up the group which owned it, and actually, when Rickenbacker bought it, I don't know that he had a great deal personally involved in it. I think it was backers, but everything that you hear or see is that Rickenbacker was the owner of the track. Well, I think what happened over a period of years was that as partners would get out and he would buy their share. So I think probably on paper he was pretty much the owner by the time that it came to sell. During World War I, it had been used as an aviation depot. I mean, it was a military presence here, and then when the World War II, when America got into World War II, Rickenbacker offered the track to the government. They came and took a look and thought, well, maybe it was okay in World War I, but you know, we can't, bombers can't take off from the infield, and so they said thank you, but no thank you, and I sense that what I know about Rickenbacker, I think he was probably a little bit miffed about that, so he just shut the whole place down. And they closed the offices, which were downtown on North Capitol, and there was no full-time office out here, and so he let Pop Myers and Dolly Dahlenbeck, his secretary, they were pink-slipped until after the war was over, and his brother Al Rickenbacker then took over to see it through the war, and he moved to the golf course. They kept the golf course open, and they ran that, and he sort of ran the Speedway operation out of there. The golf course kept going, as I say, but the track itself was just left, and it just became horribly overgrown with weeds. And if you see the photographs or the movies, I mean, it's just hard to believe that they ever saved it. In fact, the locals, I mean, I talked to locals, and some of them are still around, and they said, we just assumed it was done for because all the fences were falling down and the gates were falling down, and you could hunt rabbit, and the pit area was all overgrown, and there's weeds coming up through the cracks. So we figured it was done for. Wilbur Shaw, during the war, is in Akron, and he was like the sales manager for the Firestone Aircraft Division, and towards the end of the war, because there's a ban on racing, and the Firestone is developing a synthetic rubber tire. And so Firestone thinks, wouldn't it be great if we could test it at the Indianapolis Speedway? So they get permission from the government to do that. The first test, I think, was like three passenger cars doing like 30, 35 miles an hour. And then they said, okay, now we're ready for the real test. So they came down here with a racing car and Wilbur Shaw driving, and he ran a 500-mile test. Well, the track was so overgrown that when they came to open the gate, the padlock was rusted, and they knocked the padlock, and the whole gate fell down, and they basically had to weed the groove before they could run. And so as soon as it was done, then Shaw thought, you know, this place, it's done for. We've got to see if we can save it. So he goes to New York, meets with Rickenbacker, and Rickenbacker said, well, we're going to run after the war. Well, they had, there were several different possibilities. One was that the, was it the VFW, I think? I think it was the VFW was trying to buy it. but they didn't have enough money. I think it was the VFW. And then the other thinking was that Rickenbacker said that we'll run it, and Seth Klein and some of the other people like that would be involved. And but the general thinking was, as soon as the war was over, they're going to bulldoze the whole place, and it's going to be a housing development. So Shaw thought, no, we've got to do whatever we can to save it. And so his first idea, I don't know if I can get this in time, his first idea was that Rickenbacker apparently said, I'll sell it for what I've got in it, and it was like around $700,000. Shaw thought maybe he could get it for $500,000, but he was prepared to put some money into it, but he couldn't swing the whole thing himself. And so he wrote letters to friends and companies and people that he thought might be interested. And his thinking was, if I got to figure out what the math is here, but I think he said if we could get 20 people, see if this is right, if we could get 20 people to put up $25,000 a piece, that would be $500,000. Is that right?
I think that's right.
And then I'm assuming that he would put the rest in to get it. Well, that didn't work out. Some weren't interested. Some were, but he could see what Blemker, Al Blemker, the publicist, referred to as, I had the term and it's gone now, product exclusivity. And they didn't want that. They thought, no, we want everybody to come, and if there's going to be 15 tire companies and 20 oil companies, we'll do that. 15 spark plug companies. I'm exaggerating, but the thing was, we're not going to do any exclusives. And so anyway, then they thought, well, that's not going to work. So he had a friend named Homer Cochran, who gets no credit at all and should, and he had run dirt track a little bit in the 20s and then given up early, and now he was a real estate broker. And he had done some deals with Tony Holman. And he told Wilbur, he said, this is a fellow of Ventura Holt. I've done some deals with. You need to go meet this guy, because what they do, they've got Clavigal baking powder, and he's got a guy named Joe Cloutier, and they look at businesses that have all kinds of potential, but they've fallen on hard times. And you buy them, and in some cases, they build them up and then maybe sell them. And it would be worth a ride over there. So they go over on a date, and I have no idea what it was, but I'd love to know. But I'm assuming it was probably sometime maybe in September of 45. And they meet Tony Holman, and he knows who Wilbur Shaw is, and by golly, been going to the race, and wife has gone to the race. And Tony first came here, I think, in 1914, when he was just a teenager with his dad. And so anyway, they look into how they can do this. And I'm going to go around. I need to probably be wrapping this thing up. Tony Holman ended up buying it. But he did talk to several people and said, what do you think about it? And some thought, Mrs. Holman said, I thought it was a pig in a poke. And a lot of people thought, it's too far gone. But they could tell that Tony could see into the future, and he could see this place cleaned up. And I have had several people, when I first was around, I had probably two or three people tell me, and even one since, said, we thought our family was going to be part of it, because Tony said, what would you think if we bought the track? And they thought, he's talking to us about me being partners. And then they picked up the paper one day, and Tony bought the whole thing. Rickenbacker came to town, and they did the deal on November the 14th of 1945. How it was financed, I have no idea. The best story I heard of, and this is just, I'm just, spreading rumors here, but supposedly Joe Cloutier, I think they established the price was $650,000 or somewhere in there. And so apparently Joe Cloutier, and I will stress, this is a rumor, Cloutier excused himself and made a phone call to a guy named Joe Jacobs with Sports Services and said, if we were to buy the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, would you be interested in an exclusive on concessions. And the guy said, yes. And he said, how about 15 years at $50,000 a year? And the guy said, I'll take it. And so Cloutier came back supposedly with the track paid for with one phone call. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. I think maybe that they borrowed from the bank. There's also the possibility that Mrs. Holman put a lot through Frederick's cigar money. I don't know. I'm just gossiping here because I don't know. Maybe one day we can find out.
I remember 750 was the number.
I've heard that too. So I mean, they're all approximates.
And that when he went to do a deal, he was going to have to reveal information about his company and the price, and so he just, instead of borrowing the money, just paid for it.
That could be, and maybe that's why several people thought they were going to be part of it and found out they weren't. No, that's entirely possible, and then when you see what the family had done over the years, I think that it's easier if you don't have a partner. I mean, that would be nice, but, you know, there's no strings. You can do whatever you want to. But anyway, I hope I didn't say any of the wrong things, and I'm sorry about the other callers we didn't get to.
Well, the good news is there's always tomorrow, and as Tony Holman has provided.
We have 2 hours tomorrow.
We have 2 hours tomorrow. It's also sunshine at Indianapolis Motor Speedway tomorrow. We're promising that. Donald Davidson has guaranteed us a look into the future, and he has seen sunshine.
Oh!
We have it already here at the Speedway. It's been a great day. Donald, thanks for coming on board on short notice. We've got the Indiana Fever tonight. Tomorrow, we've got full day of qualifying on Sunday. It'll be a happening place at Indianapolis Motor Speedway. More history to be written and talked about in the future. So please join us at Indianapolis Motor Speedway and catch all Indianapolis 500 action here on 1070 The Fan. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Kurt.
The Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson.